kept on running. Run so true, I was a voice in the chorus. Then the cornflower blew, dropped me in the middle of it. In the middle of it, oh, just a little one. In the middle of it, oh, just a little one. Well, hearts run wild under the sawdust. At the foot of a mountain, I'll see you when I see you. In the middle of it, oh, just a little one.
Good morning, welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 1st of May, a brand new month, the 5th month of the year. We have finished a third of the year already, and it felt like every day of it, didn't it? But here we are, and we're ready to keep going into a new month, and we welcome you to the month of May, and one that hopefully will be bright and cheery and maybe put us into a good spirit and mood as we move forward. We have a wonderful group of panelists with us today. I just have a couple things I need to talk about. One is, first of all, I was out for a couple days. I just want to thank Sarah LaDuke and the whole team for filling in and picking up. I had mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but I had kidney stones, and so they had to come out, and so I went in for surgery, and they said, well, you know, you'll come in, and you come in at 8 o'clock, you'll probably be out by 1, and you go home. And then that didn't happen. So it involved a lot of asteroids, you know, shooting at these stones and having them try to exit my body, which then wasn't allowing them to go. So they put in a bunch of stents into my kidneys, which I still have now, and boy, are they great. But they're not as bad as the catheter. The Foley catheter, has anyone had that? Oh, no. My God. Yeah. That yeah. is horrible. Horrible. And so I spent some days with my friends at Albany Med, and so I still feel fairly crappy, but I'm going on the scale of comparing it to when I had the catheter in, so that's good, I don't feel as much like a human maraca, which is nice, but I'm not exactly ready for prime time either. But here we are. I also one of the reasons I needed to come in today was because we're getting ready for a big show. We're going to be on the road on Monday. We're going to be broadcasting from Awana, home of Frederick Church. There's the big anniversary, the centennial, is that correct? And so we have that to look forward to, and that's a big show we're getting ready for, and so that'll be happening on Monday. We sold out of tickets, so there aren't any tickets available anymore, but a reminder, if you purchase tickets and you have tickets, you'll want to use them on Monday. That'll be the day, and it should be a beautiful day, and we'll have a beautiful time, and we'll welcome you all to those proceedings. The final thing I want to mention to you before I introduce everybody and we get into the content of the show is that another reason I really wanted to be here today is because it's Public Media Giving Day. Ooh. what they did is when the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was discontinued, the former leader of that group said in their farewell speech, "Together we need to prove that a nation of neighbors really describes this country." And this whole idea had been around of public media giving days for the public and public media enthusiasts to make contributions to their local stations and to know the importance. And secondly, that people would have an awareness and can share what public media brings to their lives. So that's what we're doing today. We certainly don't want to be out in the cold and not celebrate a holiday that was apparently made up that included us. So the one interesting thing about it, I will say, is that we have public media giving days today and tomorrow. And then on Monday, we're going to hitch up for the lockbox. So just know, but it's all pretty much the same. So just know that. But I don't want public media giving days to pass by without mentioning. This is the fourth year I've been doing this. And this is American Public Television, Contributor Development Partnership, Greater Public, NPR, and PBS. And anything you can do, WAMC.org, WAMC.org for public media giving days. And we appreciate your understanding. And thank you very much for all of your love and support that we always have and that you always give us. And we very much appreciate it as we appreciate you. So with that said, let's celebrate Public Media Giving Days by giving you a really interesting discussion about the items in the news. And we do so with a terrific group of panelists. Professor of Theater at Siena University in Loudonville, New York, Mahmoud Karimi Hakak. Good morning, Mahmoud. How are you?
Thank you. Good morning to you, Joe, and happy public giving public day, whatever that is.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well as the International Workers' Day.
Right. International Workers' Day. And it's a delight to have you here. Thank you very much for being with us. We're always always pleased when you join us.
Love being here.
We welcome professor in the history department at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Allison Cavey, is here. Good morning, Allison.
Hi, I hope you guys all had a good Walpurgisnacht or Beltane last night and partied and lit a lot of things on fire. and that you're now ready for Public Radio Giving Day and also International Workers' Day.
Yes. I don't know that I did that implicitly, but I do feel like most of me is on fire. So that's, yeah. Heather Mulligan.
Microcosm.
our good friend Heather Mulligan is here, CEO of the Business Council of all of New York State. Good morning. How are you?
Wow, all of New York State.
Yeah.
Good to hear that. No,
yeah.
I was aware of that already, but thanks for...
I want them to be aware of it.
Yeah. Yeah, good morning. Happy May. I'm really excited. It's that perfect time of year where the weather is nice enough for the horses, but the flies haven't, like, really fully manifested themselves. So
no, they're coming. Judy and I were just talking about that.
Yeah, the black fly invasion begins in the next 15 to 20 days, I think.
Yeah. Up our way, I think it's already started.
Oof.
We're ready. Yeah. Yeah. So, but that's all right.
But it's nice right now.
It is nice right
and
now.
And I don't have kidney stones, so I'm feeling pretty good.
There you go. Excellent. Of course, last but certainly not least, former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, longtime editor of the Daily Gazette, and our dear friend has been a part of our radio station for many, many years. Judy Patrick is with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Sunday is World Press Freedom Day. So yes. If you love the WAMC newsroom on Sunday, you got to, I know you're busy on today, on Saturday, on Monday, but Sunday, do something in honor of World Press Freedom Day.
Would golf count?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything
yeah.
counts.
That's what
think
I'm
of us.
Yeah, it sounds like a good. One other thing I just want to make mention of, and we're not going to make a big deal about this, but I just want to mention it because I don't want it to go without being noted. But today marks the 26th anniversary of this program.
Wow.
We took to the airwaves 26 years ago with the Roundtable on May 1st in the year of 2000. Myself and Susan Arbetter were at the helm. And we've had, a fair amount of change in between, but the show is pretty much what it was when we started in various forms. It's been a hell of a ride. It's been very nice to have been here for all of it. At least where I was semi-engaged, being fully engaged, most of it. And it's just been a great thing. And I just wanted to thank the audience who has been so wonderful and so caring and so loyal over the years. And it just means a lot to us. But 26 years is, obviously we celebrated on the 25th, but 26 years is no fluke either. And so we thank you all for very much. And I don't know how much, we'll see how farther we can go with this, see how long we can ride this horse. But I'm not riding any horses at the moment. But I just want to thank everyone and the great group here and all the folks at WAMC who have had confidence in us. And, of course, our incredible producer, Sarah LaDuke, who's been with us and with me for 20 years of this. It's just a lovely thing. And Madeline Reynolds, our associate producer, and the whole group. So thanks to everyone, and thanks to the listeners and to the audience. And we'll celebrate. And if you want to give us some sort of gift, it's Public Media Giving Days. WAMC.org if you want to celebrate. All right, let's get to the world at large and the subjects at hand on this Friday morning. And we welcome your letters, as always, panel@WAMC.org. Well, it took a while. It took 11 weeks, actually, but the House has passed a DHS funding bill that would end the shutdown for most of the agency. And this came through yesterday, and this is something that has been elusive for a while. The bill that now heads to President Trump's desk for his signature funds all of DHS except Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Patrol, which Republicans plan to fund through a reconciliation bill, which would not require Democratic support. Agencies that will be funded once Trump signs the bill include the Transportation Security Administration, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the Coast Guard, and the Secret Service. The chamber approved it by a voice vote with just a few dozen members on the floor. Republicans plan to fund the department with a complicated two-track plan. One, party-line bill that would fund Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Patrol for the rest of the terms for the Trump term, pass through the reconciliation process that does not require Democrats' help, and another bill to fund the rest of DHS through September with Democratic support. House Republicans, and by the way, I'm just warning you all, September will be here before you know it. House Republicans had said that they would block the latter bill until it was clear that ICE and Border Patrol could be funded without Democratic help. A budget resolution to begin work on that process passed the House on Wednesday. Johnson told reporters of the DHS funding bill, "We threw a fit and we had to, because it left out ICE and Border Patrol. We held the Homeland bill because we had to be sure that they couldn't isolate and eliminate those two critical agencies." He spoke about the party that is not in power. All right. So, Heather, would you like to begin?
They could have done this a month ago.
Right?
What? I think that it seems like the most recent, assassination attempt seems to be what lit a fire under them, maybe? I don't know. I mean, I know that funding will run out. The emergency funding runs out tomorrow or today, maybe, for the Secret Service. And so there was a lot of pressure related to that. But, come on, guys. They could have done this already. Why do we have to create this kabuki theater around this stuff? They can do the carve out for the funding for ICE and pass it through reconciliation. They could have done that. Nothing changed that would have prevented them from doing that, long ago. I think it's embarrassing.
Embarrassing and something that, right, I think most people look at and say could have been done and should have been done a long time ago.
And, but they're trying for 11 really, weeks. Really hard to lose the midterms worse than, almost as possible.
Yeah, we can talk about that too. That's certainly seems to be, it's not many things that look to be in their favor.
Well, the only thing in their favor is that there's very few competitive seats.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so no matter what, I think the House is going to have a slim majority, but they're not doing anything to make their case, I guess.
Well, I think, first of all, I'm very glad that the people of DHS have money to eat. That's important. And I agree that this must have been done months ago. And this fiasco should really end. We go through a lot of this over and over and over. And then, you know, after months of suffering and debates and all that, everything gets done. And, well, I hope we sort of tighten the screws a little more.
Yeah. And we'll see if what impact it has. I think it is, you know, makes sense for us to be skeptical, given the track record, but we hope for the best. Judy.
So there's a reason Congress, the public's approval of Congress is at near record lows. I mean, I think it was like 9% the last Pew poll I read, and that's because they dither around like this. And at the end of the day, what did they accomplish? Nothing. I mean, the border and protection and homeland security, they are not going to stop wearing the masks. They are not going to get judicial warrants when they do things. So the Democrats didn't get what they wanted. The Republicans didn't get what they wanted. And the reason there were only a few dozen people in the chamber is because everybody else wanted to go home for another break. I mean, really? Every time I turn around, this legislature is going on break. And so the American public doesn't like the fact that they seem incompetent at doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Allison.
I was actually thinking about their holiday schedule and increasingly envious because they seem to get more weeks off than anyone else in the whole world. And
except academics.
No, we don't get that many weeks off. At least I don't. I have to work all summer. But the way these legislatures, I mean, they're not going home and having town hall meetings. The original schedule was organized so that people would, representatives would come to D.C. They would reflect the will of the people. They would vote, then go home and get more will of the people. They're not holding town halls and open house meetings and learning what their constituents want. They're hiding in their homes or going on vacation. Some of them seem to go on vacation during the session. So I just think we need to have a much more thoughtful sense of accountability for people that we elect to office.
I don't say this is going to sound like I'm saying this smart alecky, but also with that much time, it seems like a lot of these legislators are getting themselves in trouble too. Like if you know, idle time is the devil's playground. Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like there's a lot of devil's playground around by the number of congressional representatives that have been forced to leave their seats. So maybe that's also a problem.
You know, they say they're doing constituent services, but what they're actually doing is campaigning. A lot of events, they're going to chicken dinner. Well, they're trying to make money.
Yeah, they're trying
exactly.
to make money.
Yeah. They're trying to make money.
And whether that's a phone call or a visit to a closed group or whatever the case may be.
And it's not chicken dinner season now. That's usually in the winter.
I wish I could remember. Like 2 weeks ago, I was listening to an interview with a member of Congress. I don't remember if it was a Republican or a Democrat, but whoever it was a good interview. He seemed very reasonable. It was a male. That's the only thing I can tell you.
Very memorable.
Yeah. Well, but the thing that I found fascinating about it is you know, he was clearly a moderate, and he said, you know, the hardest thing is you get there and you want to do work, and you realize your whole first year, you're engaging in fundraising for other people, not even for your own campaign, but for other people. He said it's surprising how much of your entire freshman term in the House and it is about fundraising and not about actually digging into policy. And he's like, I came because I wanted to work on policy. And I got here and I was spending all my time, you know, doing. And it's the part at the party's behest. Again, I don't remember which party, honestly. But you know, it's that's not what they should be doing. That's not representing their constituents. That's not solving problems for people. That's just, I don't know, just shaking people down.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll move on to other topics, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after this short break. So you're gonna run to every matchbox dude with a crooked smile. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Listening to the music of His Golden Messenger's new album, I'm People, out today on Chrysalis Records. You can see the playlist posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. WAMC.org/roundtable for the playlist for the music this morning. Let's move on, talk a little bit about the war and check in with talk a little bit about the hearings that took place this week with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. He appeared both Wednesday and Thursday before Congress, and he argued that the Trump administration can continue the Iran war despite a Vietnam-era law that requires Congress's approval after 60 days of fighting in an apparent attempt to stave off the rapidly approaching deadline. His comments came in a hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee, where Hegseth asserted that an ongoing ceasefire between Washington and Tehran pauses the countdown. The Trump administration did not ask Congress to authorize the Iran war before launching joint strikes with Israel on February 28th. Friday, that's today, marks the 60-day deadline after which the War Powers Act requires approval from lawmakers for hostilities to continue. Hegseth declined to say whether the administration would seek lawmakers' consent, deferring to the White House. In a statement, the White House said the administration was in active conversations with the Hill regarding the 60-day deadline and warned against lawmakers trying to, quote, score political points by usurping the commander-in-chief's authority. Oh, that usurping. Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi, the Armed Services Committee's Republican chairman, told reporters after the hearing he has not been too concerned about the 60-day deadline and inclined to say whether the Trump administration should seek approval from Congress. Slight editorializing on my part, but it seems obvious that they are not too concerned about it, or they would have gotten the approval
before they left town.
Before before the war started, which seems like they could have, and they've had several chances to do this. Well, anyway, the hearing occurring as peace talks between Washington and Tehran remain stalled followed Hegseth's combative appearance Wednesday in the House, where he sparred with Democrats whom he labeled the biggest adversary we face at this point. Because of their scrutiny of the Iran war, Hegseth repeated the attack in his opening remarks Thursday, saying that defeatists from the cheap seats in both parties were undermining the war after only 2 months. The secretary appeared alongside General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Jules Hurst III, the Pentagon's acting controller. Democrats have accused Hegseth of lying to the American people about the conflict in Iran, which they say has added financial burdens to American taxpayers and lacks a clear path to victory. The defense secretary has defended the military operation as crucial to denying Iran a nuclear weapon, one of several rationales the Trump administration has offered for starting the conflict alongside Israel. That reporting from the Washington Post. I will pause that. Before I hand it over to our group of panelists, I would just like to add that this is, I think it's, we get into labels and terms and so forth. So what Hegseth is saying is because we're in a ceasefire, then the time that we're in a ceasefire should not count toward the 60 days. But if you're doing a blockade, which apparently is still on, that is an act of war. If you're shooting at ships, that's also an act of war and would seem that would violate the ceasefire. And if you are not in any And as a part of the ceasefire, you are not negotiating in any meaningful way. In fact, you have then, at the last time, taken the people off the plane and said, you're not going because we feel it's a waste of time. Then that would seem to me that that is a continuation of war, not a pause. So I throw that out as a possibility of discussion as well. Allison.
Well, I really enjoyed the 2-day long temper tantrum in which Pete Hegseth flailed around, waved his tiny hands and his little tiny arms, and every time anyone questioned him about factual things, screamed at them and refused to allow anyone to finish a sentence. This is a strategy that we could all use if we wanted to become toddlers right now. But to claim that you're not actually still in a war when there are no peace negotiations going on, when Iran yesterday said, we are not going to give up our nuclear program and we're going to keep the strait closed and we are going to control it forever, and we have no interest in negotiating about this. And as Joe just said, that we continue to bomb things, ships, etc., and where our ally Israel is continuing to bomb in Lebanon, despite the ceasefire there, it's ridiculous. Of course, we're still at war. And of course, the 60-day deadline is today. And of course, they have to have this reviewed by Congress. And if the review includes just more tiny hands screaming, at least there will be a review.
Mahmoud.
Well, you know, this is a very, this is putting me in a very tight place, both American and Iranian. My American side wants to agree with her in terms of the whole game of toddlers sitting around throwing candy bars at each other, or in this case, bitter candy bars. But my Iranian side also says that why haven't we finished this war in the side of Iran? Iran is not going to negotiate. Iran is not going to give anything until they're forced to. The idea of this war at the beginning was to make it quick, go in, hit the top generals and the top the people in Revolutionary Guards, and help the people to rise against the regime, which has been dominating them, which has been killing them for 47 years. I mean, regardless of the fact that this regime is a danger for the Middle East as well as the Europe as well as the whole world, I believe that this regime has the audacity of killing its own people, you know, 42 million of them in 2 days. And that needs to stop. At some point, I think that we have to understand as Americans, and I've said that in here before, at some point you have to understand that the price of a human life, regardless of who that human rights is, whether they are Iranians or Americans, is more than the price of gasoline, is worth more than the price of gasoline. You know, and we have to put our mind where our standards are. We need to stop this regime. That goes without saying. We have needed to stop this regime. Obama could have done that. He made a mistake, and he said he made a mistake. Biden could have done that. He made a mistake. You know, and we do not want a similar issue like Afghanistan, that, you know, Taliban, after 40 years, comes back and kills its own people again. We don't want that.
So just for a quick clarification, I apologize for interrupting you, but has that regime been, I mean, the president has said many times that he did not seek regime change, although he has brought about regime change by the killing of the leaders who were in place. So what needs to be done beyond that?
Well, I think what needed to be done from the beginning was not to stop when they began at the very beginning. You know, they killed Khamenei, they killed, you know, a couple dozen generals. They should have gone and hit those other murderers. As far as I'm concerned, they should have killed any member of the Revolutionary Guards above the rank of a general. They should have done that. And they also should have helped the Iranian people to come in the streets. You know, we had people came into the streets. People were in the streets. And the revolutionary guards would stop him and arrest them. And, you know, just to make another point, right now, over 50% of the people that you see support the regime in the streets are prisoners that they took during the January 8 and 9, 300,000 prisoners, and they all have a GPS on their foot controlling them. They have told them, these are news that you guys don't hear in here. They have told them that you either come to the demonstration in support of the regime and chant those slogans, or we're going to kill you, or we're going to execute you. And they have been executing those who didn't do this.
And
so,
their families.
And their families. In a regime like this, how would you do, why are we sitting up as human beings? Why are we sitting here and debating whether the war should go on or not? I disagree with the way that the war stopped. I think this could have been done much easier, much quicker if they had a plan to begin with, and the regime would have changed.
And that's where the two, the American you and the Iranian you, would come together. And I think with many people would agree this, so that this was not defined at the beginning of what the mission was, of what it was, what they were setting out to accomplish. And that has been a moving target since the very beginning.
That's very true.
Heather.
Oh, boy. First, the War Powers Act only applies if we were attacked, which didn't happen. So arguably doesn't even apply here, right? That being said, if they had sought pre-approval, I don't think they would have gotten it. If you look at what happened after the vote on Iraq and the folks who did vote to go into Iraq, a lot of them lost their seats. It was very unpopular. This is equally as unpopular. And it's an election year. So you've got all those factors at work. I think the whole, like, you know, what is 60 days, not 60 days? Well, excluding business days and Tuesdays and overnights. And I mean, that's just nonsense. But my biggest thing with the hearings, I find them very entertaining. I think that he provides a lot of fodder for Saturday Night Live and even better, South Park. And I'm waiting for them to do a Cartman, you know, respect my authority with Hegseth, you know. But it's, I don't understand how he thinks, or even the administration thinks, that this, you know, back and forth is helpful to them in any way. I think it just kind of doubles down. When you start making ridiculous arguments like 60 days isn't 60 days, I mean, what they could say is we need more time, and the War Powers Act, you know, allows us another 30 days, and we'll have it wrapped up by then. But they didn't plan this. I agree the regime needed to go, and it's been a threat to us for 40 years. And I think it was unlikely that Congress was ever going to approve. So they had to have a plan to get it done quickly, and it didn't work. And so now what? And unfortunately, you know, it's costing everybody money. It's very unpopular, and it's not going to we're not making friends in the global economy either because of the impact that it's having on our allies.
And the plan didn't work because they changed midway.
Yeah.
It started really well.
Yeah.
You know, but when a week after the week after killing Khamenei, they stopped. Trump suddenly stopped. He changed his mind. And that's where the problem is.
Judy Patrick.
So the 60-day deadline may come and go. And the bottom line there is, what's anybody going to do? Trump's the administration is going to go, what are you going to do about it? Take me to court? I mean, he's flexing his presidential power. The other thing, the administration has totally backed off on any concern they have expressed for the people of Iran. I'm not hearing that at all anymore. In fact, this morning I heard a conversation with a administration proxy out there saying, as long as Iran doesn't threaten its neighbors, what they do inside their country is up to them. They're never going to be a democratic republic. They're probably always going to be a theocracy. You know, let's just let them be, just as long as they're not going to threaten us. And so I think the Trump administration was trotting out this pretense that they were concerned about the people of Iran and, you know, their rights and their human rights. I think that was a pretext. I don't think they've ever really bought it. And maybe this discussion we can have in the United States can bring that back to the fore where it should be.
Hopefully.
Did you have anything? Okay. I wanted to ask about, Mahmoud, when you were talking about sort of these the dualities of how you feel about this, the idea of when American politicians who are looking at the war, even really from both sides, and talking about, obviously the right wants to make it very clear of how horrible Iran has been and how horrible Iran has been to the people. And then the left wants to make sure that they cover their toes and say that this has been a horrible thing. However, this is the way we have to treat this situation. And I'm wondering how you feel about that, of what the perhaps the accurate vantage point should be, but also the idea that the and this gets back to the overall question of, you know, what are we trying to get out of it? The strait is closed. A lot has changed as a result of the war that has caused more problems. And why I ask you this question is because military experts prior to the war were advising the president, including General Kane, that this was something that could very easily happen and become a misstep on behalf of the United States of America.
Well, it could easily happen. The regime could have easily fallen. Look, what we did in 1979, we joined hands or made a union between the human rights that Carter was promoting, and the kind of a force to send to find a leader who can go and topple the Shah. Now, we are not doing that now. We have a leader. Nobody in America wants to recognize that. I've said this in this program, 400,000 in Toronto, 250,000 in Munich, 200,000 in LA, and hundreds of thousands all over the world have come in and said, look, this is our leader. This man is our leader. And he wants us to, he's going to help us through the transition. Yet the only person who doesn't agree with that is Mr. Trump. The only person who doesn't want to meet with this man is Mr. Trump. Yet, Mr. Trump starts with saying that we want a regime change. We want to do the regime change, and then changes his mind. You know, that's not the way to treat either Americans or Iranians. You know.
And your thoughts on how handling the story we were talking about initially of Pete Hegseth and the operation of the war as an Iranian, of how you look at that, of the brashness of those statements the last 2 days?
Well, Pete Hegseth is who he is. Is another Trump, a younger Trump. I mean, we can't expect any, I don't know, I want to say politeness, that's the only word that comes to my mind, because he wasn't even polite sitting there.
Knowledge.
Knowledge. Thank you. Thank you.
Wisdom. Experience.
Yes. Things like that.
Knowledge or courtesy to others or understanding of a dialogue. I mean, our, the meetings that I saw were not a dialogue at all. It was a shouting match between this and that, and both sides. It's not only, the Republicans, also the Democrats were doing the same thing. And that is that, I've been in this country for 50 years, and I see that our House and our Senate, in many of their meetings, are turning into shouting matches as opposed to a dialogue between them. It is, and the divide between these two groups of Republican and Democrat is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, and I can see a day that America will have a civil war of a kind between the Democrats and the Republicans, because that's the way we are going. You know, we have lost the ability to converse. We have lost the ability to carry a dialogue with one another. And we saw a great example of it in the past 2 days.
I think, like, congressional hearings used to be good material. If you wanted to go to sleep, you could pop on CNN because they were so boring. Mm-hmm. Not anymore. They yep. just, you know, well, a person asks a question and then doesn't let the witness answer. And then the witness shouts over, you know, the person asking the question. And it's awful.
And before the witness says anything, you say, yes, you said yes. Yes,
yeah.
you said yes.
Yeah, right.
Although we haven't reached House of Commons status yet, where those people really yell at each other.
But they have to wear wigs, right? So, I mean, that's different. They have a reason to be angry.
But where does this, Allison, do you think, is the... Because right now we just seem to be in this cycle. And if anything, what happened on Saturday night at the correspondence dinner, however you look at that, was something that diverted our attention away from this conflict and doesn't seem to be getting the intense coverage that it was getting. And that's not a shot at the press. That's more of a shot at all parties involved who just seem to be stepping away from it for a while to not engage more in what's happening in the future, except for the Iranians, as you mentioned, that are taking some action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like there is... I was trying to reorder the New York Times front page today in my head to see if I could make it so that it had more balance. Over the last week, this is a sort of game I've been playing. And the truth is, it is impossible to create balance when every single day there's another crisis. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure there has been a time in our news cycle since the previous Trump administration that had this level of chaos and speed and lack of thoroughness in all institutional decision making. And if you pair that with the gutting of the institutions that we're seeing in the United States and across the world because USAID has lost its funding, what I think you see is an erosion of careful policy planning. Mm-hmm. And that policy is what's really missing. And I think it's what we're reacting to in our discussion today, is that without coherent policy mm-hmm. and without accomplished trained professionals to carry it out, you can't have the kind of conversation and you can't have the kind of debate that would be meaningful, would be civil, would follow the rules of engagement that we've seen over the last 50 years. I mean, it's easy to say, oh, this is just a social media thing and people have become less formal and more casual in their engagement. And that may be a cultural shift that is also affecting this. But I think there's a manipulation of reaction time by mm-hmm. this administration to cover for some of its lack of preparation, lack of planning, and the mistakes that are occurring as a result.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will take a break right after this. Boy, it doesn't seem like 26 years, does it? good morning. Welcome. We're celebrating our anniversary edition of the roundtable this morning. And we do so as how we start off every morning by talking about the news of the day. We have four incredible individuals with us to discuss what's happening in the world. Mahmoud Karimi Hakak. We welcome Allison Cavey, Heather Mulligan, and Judy Patrick. So it is wonderful to have you all here today. Let's go to just two letters, and then I want to move on to other topics. Arabella says, there is planning on the part of this administration. They are planning to create a fascist state. That is from Arabella. Then Andrew checks in and says, do you think this is a good opportunity for a third party or a third group that is in the center of both the Republicans and the Democrats to take root in order to save Congress?
It's a lovely idea, but our political system would not make the space for that. I mean, I think the primary process and all of that precludes real strength in third parties. And in states like New York, where you can get votes on multiple lines, it really does give advantage to the two-party system. I know it sounds contrarian, but if you can run as a Democrat but also get your votes counted on the independence line and the Green Party line or the conservative line, I've seen that before, conservative and liberal, you know, that makes it almost impossible for those parties to have independently successful candidates.
You know, I see Mike Pence out there, the former vice president, trying to make a case for saving the Republican or restoring the Republican Party to what it was before Trump. I think that's a pipe dream on his part, but we'll see.
Mitt Romney did that too, right? I mean, he was actively trying to recreate the Republican Party of his youth just recently.
But it has changed so much. And I don't know if it's I don't know how much you can get back and how much you want to get back, quite frankly. But also, but it has changed, and I think that leaves us wondering of you know, what kind of leader is the person who's going to speak to people enough to feel that there is a viable path forward for this country.
Who is that person?
Well, I have no idea.
No, me either.
Yeah.
I
have no idea. But I think that's what we're searching for. And also TikTok. I mean, we have... meaning you've got the midterms coming up, and then before you know it, you're going to be talking about, I know the next few years is going to seem like an eternity. I'm not saying that. But, you know, when the show is 28 years old, we are going to, you know, we're still going to be in an election cycle. And then what? You wonder where you would think it's at this point you would start hearing on both sides, on both of those two parties, a strong voice coming out. To speak and trying to, God forbid, sound like a leader.
Yeah, well, it's hard for people who sound like leaders to win primaries, which was my point previously.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
that's true. But
you know that makes it hard. I mean, I think Chris Gibson, his book, The Spirit of Philadelphia, is all about getting back to the idea of representative government, representing your constituency, meaning not just the ones with the same party name, but everyone that you represent. I do think, you know, there's a lot of people having conversations about what is leadership. I think we need to fix the primary system, and we need to apportion votes in the Electoral College if we really want to see anything happen. And yes. What I mean by that is not cast your Electoral College votes so as the popular vote goes. I mean within each state, apportion them so that everybody's vote counts regardless of whether or not they're in the majority or the minority. I think that will restore credibility back to government, and it will take away a lot of the power that you know, that large overwhelming majorities have in any state. So an overwhelmingly red state or a state like Florida, think about this for a minute, used to be relatively close, Democrat, Republican. It was not long ago a swing state. If those votes were divided based on how people voted within the state, it would make sense for the people who were on this slim minority for their votes would count. And in New York, the 38% of people who voted for Trump, their votes would have counted in the Electoral College process. It would change campaigning. You would have to be more moderate. And I think the control the extremes have over both parties is what has created the opportunity for this kind of damage. And you know, that and the anonymity of the internet and the, you know, the total loss of manners that people have in dealing with each other.
And the lack of education. We don't teach our kids the civics. You know, that's a big problem. We don't teach our we don't talk about politics with our kids. You know, in classrooms you're not supposed to speak about politics. You're not supposed to say anything against somebody's belief. And so the dialogue is lost all over.
Yeah, there's zero tolerance for disagreement, exactly. And I would say that is both extremes. It is not mm-hmm. that is not exclusive.
Yeah,
I mean, we could debate who's worse. I don't think it matters.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. Doesn't matter. And you know, and to the writer's point, I hope that in this country we have a third, a fourth, a fifth, and a tenth party, because we really need it. We really need people to become a lot more active in their politics.
You were going to say something right before.
I was looking to the history professor to actually talk about the roots of the reason why the small states have so much power in terms of electing presidents and controlling the Senate. I mean, it goes way, way back. And in dissent has always been an important part of our functioning democracy. And just going back to the Hexa thing, he's one of those, my country right or wrong, don't you dare criticize anything mm-hmm. I'm saying. When we criticize stuff, we're doing our jobs as citizens. So.
But Hegseth says my country, what he means is 36% of the United States country, right? He doesn't mean the whole country. And in fact, in many ways, I think he's only speaking about Trump.
His country.
Exactly. Like Trump himself is the country. And once you start, I mean, I've said this before, but once you start to say l'état c'est moi, what you have is a descent into monarchy and a thoughtless gut reaction that everything the leader says has to be accepted and unquestioned, and that is not American. And the idea of the sort of celebration of rabble, which is the House, we actually need a stroppy, obnoxious House. The House should be fighting. It should be arguing. And it should be arguing within itself to hash out these big questions and to have the middle ground that Heather was referring to come through. I mean, the power of the United States as a historical entity was that middle ground, which is a very famous book by Richard White, which I now am footnoting because I'm a geek. But the idea is that you sort of collaborate to build a conversation from both sides by having a common set of interests and a common dialect and a common language. And I think increasingly there is little desire for that.
No, there's no space or room for compromise or dissent. And that is generally become more and more true, I think, broadly through society. If mm-hmm. if you don't agree with someone on one aspect of politics, they're just all bad, and there's no willingness to even hear them out. And because I think a lot of people come to their positions and their viewpoints based on their own lived experience, based on a lot of things. It's not pulled out of the air just to be mean and oppositional. But there's always, I think, not always, but frequently an assumption that this person, because they don't agree with me, I hate them and they hate me, and that's all there is to it. And their beliefs are unfounded completely. And it's almost never, I mean, setting aside, Idiocracy, racism, that kind of stuff. But people believe things like, if you think about pro-choice, pro-life, it's not just as black and white as that. People have mm-hmm. very nuanced opinions on that. Sometimes it's religious, sometimes it's not. Mm-hmm. And the idea that someone who's on the other side is either evil or some kind of, zealot is just, it's wrong to cast people that way without having, you need to listen to them. You need to hear how they come to their opinions. And you can't do that if you're just shouting at each other all the time.
But nuanced opinions comes as a result of a discussion, a conversation, a dialogue.
Agreed.
Right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I've been teaching for 50 years and I see less and less the ability of a professor to criticize a student's paper. I cannot go to my class and say what you are giving me is not worthy, because I have insulted the student. because, you know, I have to face... Well, you know,
there, I mean, there was a movement in New York to have kids not take tests because it was stressful. You know, I mean, come on. How are you going to get through life, right?
So monarchy is inside us. You know, and it's growing. In America, monarchy is growing within individuals, unfortunately. And I tell you, from a person whose history consisted of 25 centuries of monarchy, and this is going to sound really bad, but I wish monarchy on you guys so you understand what we went through and what we are going through. Sorry.
Well, the day's young.
Yeah.
it's only 10:18.
I mean, who knows?
Really cool parades and castles and stuff.
Yeah.
By the way, the monarchy would like to remind you that it's a public radio giving day. So whatever that's worth.
King Joe.
Yes, there you go. Let me go to just two more letters and then we'll move on to other topics. Let me go to this letter. Ellen says, most of the discussion I'm hearing from the panel regarding this absurd war on Iran does not, address the reason we are fighting in Iran. There is hardly any mention of what Israel is doing in Lebanon or Gaza. There is no mention that we entered this war with and for Israel. This is very disturbing to me. Okay. Anyway, Iran did not attack the United States and was not and is not an imminent threat. We can agree Iran is a horrible, oppressive regime, but there are other countries with nuclear weapons that are under horrible dictatorships and are oppressing their people. But we do say and we do little or nothing about them. Our president is irrational, as is this war with Iran and Israel. And I think there's a lot in this letter, but I think maybe the main point was that we did not talk enough in our conversation about Lebanon and Gaza as it pertains to this particular conflict. I'm not sure that is what they were going for, but that's what I took out of it. Okay. Let's go to this letter from Raphael, who says it won't be one person we all get behind, but this needs all of us, or at least a huge groundswell, to turn this country around. We cannot pin it on one savior. There is no hero. It is on us. And Raphael loves the panel. And Raphael, I thank you very much. We also want to check in with Mike. I'd like to say, concerning the extremes of the two-party system, we do not have a so-called extreme left wing in America. The most left-leaning politicians around would be considered moderate in any European country. Thanks, and keep up the great work on the panel. People are very, very nice today on our anniversary. I'd like to say about the concern... Oh, okay, I think that was another version of the letter I just read. And all right, let's move on to.
Wait, can I respond to Mike just for one
second?
You
sure can.
He actually raised something I was trying to sort of think through when we raise this. I can sort of identify the talking points of the far right in this country pretty pretty clearly.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I can identify the talking points of the far left.
Really?
No, I'm sorry, I don't think I can.
Elimination of private ownership of enterprise. It's okay to execute a CEO of a health insurance company.
One guy.
Well, no, but he's got accolades. I mean, he's got people who are in love with him.
That's not the far left political party.
But is that an agenda?
Well, okay. I'm just saying there are people on the far left and the far right, and at some point they actually meet.
Okay,
you
but
go
I'm,
far
I
enough
want to
around
go
the
back
circle.
To my original question. Can we talk about a platform that is the far left? Because I
don't think... Democratic Socialists of America, privatization, the taking away private property. It's on their webpage. It's like the first
but
thing.
She's right. It's not really far left. I mean, you know,
well,
when you
I think that's
far
pretty
left,
far left.
It is left, but it's not far left.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that the people who identify as a leftist Democrat would choose that.
Well, Democratic Socialists of America, a growing movement.
Okay, that's one group.
But it's far left.
I'm going to repeat. Among people who identify as far left Democrats, what are shared policy points?
anti-business, you know, taking assets from the wealthy. And you know, I'm not saying they're right or wrong, but I'm saying there are clear elimination of fossil fuel as a source of energy generation. I mean, I think there are platforms. We can debate whether or not they're moderate in another country, but those are
last two seem to me pretty rational.
You, because you live in New York, if you go to Arkansas, go to Kentucky.
Well, I mean, do travel quite a bit, and yeah. What I would argue here is that I don't think that's a coherent platform for everybody who identifies as the far left. And so the coherence that has occurred under Trump, and really probably starting with Palin, to coalesce a populist movement in the far right has not occurred on the far left in this country. And so there's this sort of inconsistency in our ability to generate that kind of popular movement on the left compared to the right.
I happen to disagree. I mean, I think that there's a propensity for setting aside the guardrails of democracy on both sides, the extreme left and the extreme right. And whether or not you want to or anyone can assign a strict party label to either, I think there are, my point is there are, for most people, they're not on either side of that. And, you know, there are people who will disagree with things like continued dependence on fossil fuel. That doesn't mean they disagree with a transition to a cleaner climate, but how you get there is very much dependent on where you sit politically.
But isn't what Allison is saying a much more intelligent way of saying what has been said about the parties for years, which is the right is very clear in what they want to do, and the left and the far left is a circular firing squad. I mean, isn't that essentially, I mean, I'm dumbing it down, obviously.
Yeah, no, I mean, here I am, a person who I think clearly identifies as politically democratic and who has probably a range of democratic ideas within that model. But I, a person who spends a lot of time talking about politics, thinking about politics, reading about politics, cannot identify a platform in my own party. And one thing the Republicans did last time, and it's really MAGA, not the Republican Party, but the MAGA group did so well, was to pick two hot button issues that were, in my opinion, not definitive, not defining the Democratic Party, say we all believed in them, and get everyone to flip on those two things. And I think that, you know, the 8% of people who are swing voters can be pushed with that kind of smart political modeling. And I don't see the Democrats having any political modeling, never mind smart political modeling. And so when we say we would like to see a person emerge as a clear candidate, I think we better take a step back before we shove someone in front of the lights and say, what do we want? What do we want? Do we want civil discourse? Do we want a Habermasian public sphere? Do we want to come together as a country and have a conversation? Or do we want to keep screaming at each other and waving our tiny hands in the middle of Senate hearings?
I love the tiny hands.
I'm
enjoying that.
He has tiny hands.
I want to, let's real quick go to some, I think, interesting letters on just what we heard. Dear Heather and others, the so-called far left does not want to take money from anyone. We want the uber rich to pay their fair share of taxes for all the benefits they receive, just like the rest of us. That is
New York has. Can I just? New York has the most progressive tax system in the country. The 1% of the highest income earners in the state pay around 40% of the income taxes. So the argument that they're somehow not paying their fair share, at least by that metric, which is the largest, you know, generation of revenue for the state, is just not true.
But perhaps the letter writer is referring to the federal tax system.
Right.
Well, perhaps so. I mean, those numbers are not the same, but
I am familiar.
Right. But they are still overweight and in terms of high income earners versus low income earners.
Not compared to 1972.
Well, maybe not, but I don't think I want to go back to 1972. I mean, I don't think the economy was in particularly good shape then.
It's not in particularly good shape now.
Well, it was definitely in better shape now than it was then.
John writes to us and says, referring
Wait
to
six
the
months.
Referring to the extremes of the Democratic Party, I assume points to people like Bernie or AOC. Let me see what they do stand for: working on income equality, universal health care, not involved in endless wars. That's so radical compared to fascist thugs with masks killing people on our streets.
But I don't think of them as the far left.
Are they
the far
left? That's the problem. Sanders cannot be considered far left.
He's like a normal guy.
Actually,
who wants things that to me
is the most moderate person you can imagine these days.
I think outside of New York, though, most people would think of him and AOC as the far, as representative of the far left.
Terry,
then is Elizabeth Warren also representing
yes.
the far left?
Right.
I
yes.
think so.
Wow.
So Terry says, what is the far left? One, Medicare for all. Two, stop supporting the Israeli Zionist project. Please discuss.
You know, there's a Republican candidate for senator in Massachusetts, John Sununu. He is advocating for a work requirement for Medicare. I mean,
for Medicare?
For Medicare. I thought he misspoke.
Oh, my God.
When it comes to the MAGA faithful, I saw them rally to their support. Well, you know, old people, they could sit at desks and do jobs. They don't have to be, you know, mobile to work. And it's like there was a real call on social media that says, yeah, that's a good idea. Make those Medicare people work for their insurance.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss, and we will do exactly that. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will return after this.
Everybody's getting older.
You know, when you're in a theater and you say, all right, now's the time I got to go to the bathroom, so I'm going to get up and I'm going to go. And then when you come back, you say to your spouse, did I miss anything? And they go, yeah, two people died. And you really? Yeah, it was like amazing. Yeah, like it's a real plot point. You missed the whole damn play. That sort of happened while we were away on a news break. So nobody died, but we had a really vital, good conversation. So we'll attempt to sort of back up so you can all catch up. But it was really good stuff. I also like this new thing where I see this. I know baseball does this. They're doing it on Colbert. They do it on other shows where when they go to CNN's doing it now too. When they go on a commercial, they say we'll be back after these messages. And of course we can't do this because we're not video. But and then they have the commercial in the corner and then they show and like it's a small thing of what they're doing live in the studio and they're moving things around and they've got the chairs and they're putting new guests in and they're putting out all the stuff. And it maybe it'd be nice if we could just sort of have like a
don't put ideas in people's heads.
No,
Joe.
I know.
I am not television
point.
Material.
And of course all of that takes money and that would require more public media days.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. All right, let's talk about this topic, which I think is a very interesting one, which is about, this has been going back and forth. During the break, we started to land on healthcare, and we're talking about healthcare. So I thought we would talk about what happened yesterday when President Trump named a new leadership team at the Centers for Disease Control 2 weeks ago. Public attention focused on Dr. Erica Schwartz, his nominee to be the agency's director. Her public support of vaccines was interpreted by some as a sign that Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s quest to limit childhood immunizations might be coming to an end. But another senior official Mr. Trump named to the team shares many of Mr. Kennedy's views, suggesting the potential for continuing tension at the public health agency. Mr. Trump appointed Dr. Sarah Brenner, a deputy commissioner at the Food and Drug Administration, and a self-described MAHA, Make American Healthy Again, mom, to be Mr. Kennedy's senior counselor for public health, a post that, unlike the CDC director, does not require Senate confirmation. A look at Dr. Brenner's background suggests she is aligned with Mr. Kennedy on some of his signature issues, including skepticism about vaccines and a strong belief in the importance of fitness. The public health counselor serves as the liaison between the health secretary and the CDC and on occasion the White House. As such, Dr. Brenner, who starts the job in a couple of weeks, will be Mr. Kennedy's eyes and ears at an agency he has been warring with through most of his tenure as the nation's top health official. She will be based in Washington in the office of the secretary and will most likely meet with top officials at the CDC at least once every day. She will also be Mr. Kennedy's liaison to the National Institutes of Health, an agency that has come under fire for making large cuts to medical research grants. And so this is what we're looking at as of yesterday, some changing around of the messaging, let's say, of the Centers for Disease Control. Go ahead, Allison.
Well, I mean, it's my fault that we're talking about this, so thank you. But to me, this is just a stealth move. He knows that this is an unpopular position and that even the doctor from Louisiana who voted to approve Kennedy is probably not going to do it again. Measles epidemics throughout the country continue to be a significant issue. And so what he wants to do is put in someone who is not going to be reviewed and will maintain a MAHA anti-vaccination campaign. And then the people he's putting up for review are more moderate in their vaccination approach. But they're not more moderate in a lot of things. There was a wonderful NPR session this morning with the first Trump Surgeon General. His name is Jerome Adams. And he talked about the responsibility in the Surgeon General position and that it's a balance between public health commitments and the idea of private responsibility. And I thought that was such a smart way to discuss it, because when you have public health as your priority, or at least as part of your context, you start to say things like, it's very hard for children to exercise outside if they live in a place where they can't go outside without being shot. And if you live in a food desert, the only food that's available is often highly processed, less nutritious, and very expensive. Those are the sort of hallmarks of public health beyond the sanitation realities, right? If you live in a place with a lot of mosquitoes, you're more likely to get West Nile virus, you're more likely to get malaria, things like that. But the public health side of this is important. If you're the Surgeon General, you cannot say everyone should go do 50 sit-ups and it's totally up to you if you give your children vaccines, because vaccines are a public health responsibility and sit-ups are a private responsibility.
Exactly.
And it's hard to balance those two things. And what I see in the current administration is an obsession with eating enormous amounts of red meat and doing a lot of badly done pull-ups and not a lot of thought about things like poverty defining health outcomes in this country. And the anti-vaccination position comes from an extraordinary position of privilege. We get to say things like, I've never seen measles kill a child, because we have had vaccine mandates for a very long time. Vaccines work.
Anyone else?
I just think there's a bizarre element to the sort of the direction of healthcare policy. I mean, first off, working out in denims and work shoes and a belt and no shirt. If you haven't seen that,
you should keep your shirt on.
Yeah, yeah.
Keep your clothes on.
And then,
on.
You know, finishing your workout by getting into a hot tub with your jeans on and drinking some whole milk. And if you haven't seen
raw milk.
So we like raw milk, but the same guy.
But we don't like botulism, which is weird.
Right. The same guy is saying, let's take microplastics out of water,
which is good.
Right. It's good, but it's interesting that it's coming from the same source. It's, you know, this is a guy who picked a dead bear up off the side of the road and put it in his car overnight.
A raccoon as well.
I don't even understand.
Only a portion of the raccoon.
I don't even understand how this is the person who's in charge of making policy on this stuff. You know, he could be right on some things and wrong on some things, but I think the overarching message is it's kooky.
It's an incoherent platform,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
the idea of make America healthy again, it's catchy, But the people who've gotten behind it are coming from very different positions. Mm-hmm. I mean, to say we should probably stop using poisons as fertilizer because they go into the water table, combined with, also, I think we should take a lot of supplements on Amazon.
Yeah.
You know, 26 years ago, at the when the millennium was changing, you know, 1999 to 2000, we wrote big stories back then about what important things happened to our civilization to move it forward. And one of the primary things was public health. I mean, that has changed how we live in dramatic ways, and it's hard for us to realize how poor our health was, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, or 1,000 years ago. And so I think we can't lose sight of the value public health policies play in our lives. That being said, my Fruit Loops still are brightly colored. I thought we were going to get rid of that red dye. And acetaminophen, or Tylenol, remember it was almost a year ago that they were telling pregnant women not to take that. I think that, that there was some link between that and autism. I think RFK Jr. was before the Senate this week or last week saying that garbage, the studies that prove that that's not true are just garbage, which is, we need a coherent, thoughtful, scientific approach to public health, and we need an advocate out there that will talk about things like allowing children to play more, to have people have good access to good quality food. I mean, our society is changing so dramatically where we just have these mega superstores and people without cars have a hard time getting to them, or, they'll have to pay a $20 surcharge to have the food delivered to their house. I mean, the Surgeon General, the Surgeon General for that label on all those cigarette boxes. And it's one of the reasons I never have smoked a cigarette in my life, because they came out in the, in the 60s and said, don't do this. I mean, that's the value that public health at the federal level can play. That being said, we talk about, Republican ideals and conservative ideals. You tend to think of them as small government. But the fact that RFK Jr. is out there saying to regulate food dye, to regulate microplastics, is so totally counter to what conservatives generally stand for and what this administration stands for when it comes to the EPA.
Why can't we just learn from countries that have successfully mingled the public and private health care? Look at Europe. Our next door, our 51st state, Canada. They
wouldn't like you saying that.
I know they wouldn't. My wife is Canadian, yeah. So I'm allowed.
Okay.
But, why can't we just find ways to get the best of both of these and make a policy that really works? Because neither this works nor that.
But yeah, I think one thing, I was actually just talking about this with some colleagues, so one thing I'm thinking about is how we balance activism, work, whatever your professional work is, and reaching out in some way, in some positive way. So activism for things that you want, your professional goals, and, teaching or working with people or helping people, however you want to put it. When we look at the balance, and that's what I think does create a sort of functional, for example, national healthcare system, we don't see the kind of equal valuing of those things in this country that I think we maybe saw 30 years ago. I think there was a bit more push toward the latter one, maybe the first and the third. But as a result, the enthusiasm for doing something like dramatically restructuring the healthcare system so that we would have access to good prenatal care for everyone and good... For me, I would start with good prenatal care, good pediatric care, and good geriatric care. If we could reorganize the world to look like that for the next 10 years, I would be really proud and really excited about the direction healthcare was going. When we talk about public health, we've been the beneficiaries of an extraordinary public health system for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the breakdown of that system is not as far away as you think. Things like sanitation are local, but public health is hyper-local. Those are community decisions. Yeah. And you saw that fabric really come through during the COVID epidemic, where there were these highly localized decisions about mask wearing and keeping a business open, keeping it closed, all that stuff. If we tried to nationalize that, we would be in trouble. But we do need to come up with a coherent set of principles, shared ideas. And that's what I think, again, we keep going back to this idea of a lost, or I keep going back to it, but lost civil discourse. We don't want to talk about it. We just want to yell at each other.
So I agree with you 100%. And I think it goes all the way back to the issue of the politics and the art of opposition and the money being more important than the underlying drivers of democracy, of, you know, the value system, getting elected to represent your constituents, regardless of whether or not they're your party or not your party, regardless of whether or not they like you or don't like you, but doing it for the betterment of your community, that is long gone. I mean, it is, you can see that, I think, if you step outside of public health, which I agree. Again, I agree with you 100% on that. And you look at immigration. There are solutions to this. Mm-hmm. And there are people on both sides who will agree to a solution. But the politics of not having an agreement and the politics of having something to disagree with the other side about are more, they generate more interest, more clicks, more news stories, and more money.
Yeah, more money.
And it's self-perpetuating. And it's really unfortunate.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up the show. And for this Friday edition, we welcome your letters. Last chance, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will return right after this.
And I swear to you, this is what she said. Well, I can tell by your lines, you're in solitary flight. You may be the first true unknown. Oh, but baby, pretty soon you're gonna need somebody. Nobody makes it alone.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable as we wrap up our Friday edition for this 1st of May. And we hope you have a beautiful weekend. I just want another reminder. On Monday, we will be broadcasting live from Owana, and we are going to be on the road, WAMC on the road, and we'll be broadcasting from the Frederick Church Center in Hudson, New York. Now, it's a ticketed event, and we're out of tickets, but you can listen to us on the radio because we'll be broadcasting it, and we're going to be celebrating, I think I may erroneously have said centennial as opposed to bicentennial.
You do.
It's, thank you. It's the 200th anniversary of Frederick Church's birth, 200th birthday party, and there's a big party happening tomorrow. At the Owana State Historic Site in Hudson, and you can take part and find out more. All you have to do is go to their website, owana.org. It also has information about our event as well. Owana.org, owana.org, and that will be Monday's show on WAMC. Okay, so I thought we would end with a story that I just found to be fascinating, and so let's talk about it. And that is about the agriculture department. It is about crops, and it is about the reliability of data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This from the New York Times. The agriculture department projected last July that farmers would harvest 86.8 million acres of corn in autumn. The projection was repeatedly revised upward until, in January, the department found 1.3 million more acres of corn, an area larger than the state of Delaware. It concluded that the final amount harvested was 91.3 million acres, not 86.8 as originally thought. It was a miss, no other way to call it, said Seth Meyer, who served as the department's chief economist until leaving in December. The 5% undercount may seem small, but it was the department's worst projection in recent memory. It came as the Trump administration was cutting staff at the agriculture department. It also showed that the president's trade war was raising prices for equipment and hurt exports in the process of those crops. Some people in agriculture have become increasingly worried about the reliability of department data. That skepticism could lead to a breakdown of the historically close relationship between the department and farmers that it serves. The USDA has always had a great relationship with its farmers, said Mr. Mayer, who now leads the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute at the University of Missouri. That seems to have weakened. We're seeing some of the effects, Judy, obviously, of cuts. And while this may seem, for some who read it, as a small thing, is a really big thing.
Oh, I love ag statistics. I mean, when I was a reporter, you go to USDA or even in New York State, their agriculture, ag and markets division, you can learn so much. And they keep such great track of what's being produced, where it's being produced, where the money is being spent. In this scenario, they're relying on farmers to reply to postcards or requests for information. This is the Labor Department does as well, I think, for a lot of their hiring. And you can understand, you know, they got a lot going on. Do they really want to do that, or do they really trust the USDA to input their data as well as they should? I mean, it's such a huge industry, and with the commodity markets and playing such an important role in substantial parts of the economy, I think the fact that they failed on this is really important, and they need to figure out what went wrong and how they can fix it. That being said, you know, farmers get a lot of federal subsidies, and in exchange for the subsidies, for them to fill out a form, probably lots of forms with lots of questions, I think it's a reasonable request.
Heather?
Is it because they didn't fill out the forms, or because, you know, somebody who's supposed to be inputting the data into the system is, you know, looking at TikTok videos on their phone or just gone, right?
It sounds like they've been, I mean, because of the cuts,
yeah.
There's that.
Yeah, there's that, yeah. But, like, at some point, some information is probably just not being processed, right? And, you know, I don't know what ultimately the impact is other than projecting what the subsidies would be, maybe. I mean, some of the subsidies are to not grow things, I think. Yeah. So I'd be curious as to, like, what is the impact of the undercount other than, you know, that the guy swiping through TikTok videos probably doesn't have a job anymore if it was his job to be the ultimate. I mean, if he's as accurate as the Farmer's Almanac, right? Is that the, how do you measure yourself?
No, I mean, the response rate was low. It was, the percentage was 10 to 15% lower than traditionally that they get responses from farmers. So there is that. And I'm hoping that in this day and age, they don't use postcards. Maybe it's an electronic form they need to fill out. But I think there's some real-world consequences. I mean, farmers, they rely on the weather, but they also rely on government to provide them important information about what to plant, mm-hmm. when to harvest, what their competitors are doing, and what the world market will yield for them going forward. And at a time, I mean, farmers seems to be always in crisis. But at a time of crisis, either it's the weather or a war or the price of their fertilizer and their diesel, I think the fact that they can't rely on this data is a big fail for the government. But again, there are universities like Cornell does some really good agricultural economic statistics, and I'm sure out in the Midwest they do a lot of it, so that you can always fall back on what your state agencies are doing or your local land university is doing. Is that what they used to? Land grant university is doing. But I mean, we can't really forget how important ag is to what we do as a society.
I mean, ultimately, I think it's good news. I like corn, more corn than we thought.
Right? Oh, that's not the kind of corn. I think it's probably cow corn.
Yeah,
but I could be wrong.
Yeah, who knows? That's another good point. All right, the show is ended. We may go in peace.
Happy anniversary, Joe. That's
to give, right. Thank you very much. It's, it just seems unbelievable.
26
it's been,
years? It's
been 26 years yeah. doing this show. I've been here 31, 32?
You haven't aged a bit.
No. Wow. And my body's really holding up. but in all seriousness, if you can help out on public media giving days today and tomorrow, support WAMC, help us. We're going to start getting into lockbox territory and then the fund drive that comes up in June. So we need you as always. We always need you, and this is no exception. WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and I thank all of you for being with us this morning. Great pleasure to have you here. We'll be back right after this.